melt your face right off your skull.
Look out!
And make your iPod only play Jethro Tull.
Look out!
And tell you knock knock jokes while you're trying to sleep.
Look out!
And make you physically attracted to sheep.
Look out!
Steal your identity and your credit card.
Look out!
Buy you a warehouse full of pink leotards.
Look out!
Then cause a major rift in time and space and leave a bunch of Twinkie rappers all over the place.
That's right, it's a virus alert.
TV the immediate need before someone gets hurt. Forward this message onto everybody.
Virus alert.
TV the immediate need before someone gets hurt. Forward this message onto everybody. Warn all your friends, send this to everybody. Tell everyone, you know, tell everybody now. If you get infected,
welcome, welcome to the Three Left Show. I'm your host, Dan Platt, here live in the studio at WCAALP, The Voice. Also live streaming at grandstreetarts.org. This is the leftist reading hour that discusses anything of interest from a radical left perspective, promoting a post-capitalist present and future via direct democracy and a commons economy. This program is going for a different direction. Now, that is my general mission statement. But of course, the discussion today will be what is on everybody's minds, the virus, how we react to it. I'm going to discuss various left-wing tendencies and reactions to it, both in direct action. What I am missing is a piece on mutual aid networks. Look into that yourself, mutual aid networks. Let's see if I get to that during the break. But first, the first hour will be mostly containing some anti-capitalist discourse, commentary on the crisis. Let's call it a crisis. It's what it is. It's how we feel. Well, here is a comment from, don't even ask me who this is, actually, to someone who's, I guess, on my friends list. It's in my Facebook feed, but it's a pretty good start for the show. It is from a Philippe Goyani. So I actually don't know anything about them, but let's just, the source doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Really, the words matter. Let's see. So I've been thinking about the whole coronavirus thing, the plight of the world. I've been asked what I think about it by several people, and I wasn't sure at first. But after mulling it over, I've come up with a few thoughts. I've been trying to come up with a general abstract conception of the whole thing. Gotta think about the whole thing. It seems that the bourgeois state, you know, the liberal capitalist government that we have, is doing the only thing possible at this late stage in the pandemic. There's a global crisis that highlights the absurdity of normal life in capitalism. The state is invoking war powers to rescue its economy and money, which is pretty strange because it's a virus and can't be cured with guns and bombs. It shows the competition of states. China says the U.S. is responsible. The U.S. claims the inverse. The citizens then parrot the xenophobia. It's all so-and-so's fault. Those dirty foreigners. Keep them out. The media reports an uptick in nationalist violence against Asians. The various nations point out their relative success in containing the spread of the virus. South Korea has been effective, Italy not. Nations compete for drugs and medical equipment, which are in short supply. The sanctions in Iran help weaken the regime. So basically all states show a lack of preparedness and where their priorities lie, i.e. in keeping abstract wealth healthy and alive. Its citizens are just resources to this end. The steadfast commitment to freedom in the U.S. is remarkable, though. The officials know full well the dangers of transmission, but only close down Miami Beach and postpone holy elections after the owl of Minerva has long taken flight. The ability to have wisdom. I don't like to make prognosis, but I imagine freedom will be the first thing to go as full effects of the virus unfold. Side note, it's a general commentary about what will bring down America, and it's usually the thing that makes us unique, like strengths eventually become weaknesses given enough time. So if our strength is our freedom, it will also be our greatest weakness. Assuming the right-wingers are screaming about biological warfare by China. However, even if this were true, how is China to blame for the incredibly hellscape condition of America's healthcare system or the precariousness of the working class? That's just capitalism. Hospitals only have enough beds, gloves, face masks, and ventilators at all because they want as low an inventory as possible to keep costs low and profits high. Needless to say, the economic fallout is going to be enormous. The media is talking about 20% unemployment. In response to this, Trump is proposing checks of $1,000 to every American. Side note, he says a lot, but doesn't do a lot. Always keep that in mind. He says what people want to hear. Democrats will, some Democrats, responsible ones, I suppose, will say everything except what you don't want to hear. But Democrats want even less. They want it to be means tested and want to add a whole layer of bureaucracy when it's obvious that won't do anything. It's also funny that Trump is taking measures that would have been inconceivable to Obama at the height of the last economic crisis, e.g. a memorandum on evictions. The shelter-in-place orders make it explicit what everyone knows, that there are some workers who are essential, which include people who make and deliver food, but get paid crap, and a whole ton of workers who do nothing that relates to the material needs of people, but has to do with making money and keeping the system going. If the economy were about meeting needs, then literally 80% of work could be put in the dustbin of history. It's also widely amusing how Americans are responding. Gun sales are way up, and everyone assumes the pandemic will lead to hoarding and chaos. The idea is that everybody is your potential enemy, who would take what you have. There is a sense that everything stands on the precipice of an abyss, and it's only a matter of time before relations dissolve into open conflict and violence. Americans fear that their government will treat them the way the government treats the world. The politicians and celebrities intone that we are all in this together, and yet in times of normalcy, they would have a stroke at the idea that there's something wrong with competition for money. It's a ridiculous idea that those who benefit from the labor of others, who then take off their second or third homes, are in the same boat as those who have $1,000 to their name, if that. As those who have nothing but their labor to sell, it is precisely the competition and freedom that leads to the paranoia and anxiety about looting, because the state enforces it and would actively attempt to crush any and other form of economic organization. Everyone has to make their own way in the world with whatever means they have. And it's no secret that most people only have themselves as their means. And if they can't sell themselves for a wage, then they would turn to crime before questioning private property, as has been the case. This is one of the costs of freedom, unending anxiety about procuring one's existence in the wild free for all of the market. For all the empty chatter about politicians, about unity, one has to notice the nationalist attitude. The United States, China, and Europe are battling to be the first to find a cure. This brings a nationalist element to a worldwide crisis. States calculate that the winner gets the chance to favor its own population and potentially gain the upper hand in dealing with the economic and geostrategic fallout from the virus. So they only mean we, Americans or Germans, Italians at all, are in this together, and is nothing but a lie that ignores the antagonism and conflicting interests that are at the heart of this nation. So there's a general outline of everything I'm going to cover in this show today, this program, although I just took up a good 10 minutes. But it's the abstract version of, you know, the lefty commie rant. Now to go into more detailed versions of it that go into, that have the explanatory power. You know, that was a sketch that would probably sound like gibberish if, the first is from Slate and was getting some good sharing action, at least in my circles, my socialist circles. It's from Slate, though. Slate doesn't always publish everything great, but this one certainly is. So maybe I'll look at this writer a bit more in the future. It's Dan Coyes, and it is titled America is a Sham. Maybe you already knew this, but what does it really mean? How angry can you get? Because anger could lead to action. America is a sham. Policy changes in reaction to the coronavirus reveal how absurd so many of our rules are to begin with. Now, there's more at work than is suggested here. So do not take anything as being totally absolutist. It's more about making the point, among many other points to be made. Maybe it will be the hand sanitizer that finally exposes the sham. The Transportation Security Administration, TSA, announced Friday that due to the coronavirus outbreak, it's waiving the familiar 3.5-ounce limit for liquids and gels for hand sanitizer only. You may now bring a bottle of Purell as large as 12 ounces onto the plane to assist in your constant sanitizing of yourself, your family, your seat, your bag of peanuts, and everything else. All other liquids and gels, however, are still restricted to the 3.5 ounces. Among many shocks of the past week, school closures, Tom Hanks, the shuttering of one sports league after another, this rule change registers as major. The liquid restriction has been a key component of air travel since 2006. If people are now allowed to bring 12-ounce bottles of hand sanitizer onto planes, won't the planes blow up? So as I read this in my head, I was reading in my head, you know, I was actually crying. I was getting so mad, and then I had to kind of read it out loud in order to keep the emotions in check there. So let's see how I may get really loud. And the TSA can declare this rule change because the limit was always arbitrary. It's just one of the countless rituals of security theater to which air passengers are subjected every day. Flights are no more dangerous today with the hand sanitizer than yesterday. And if the TSA allowed you to bring 12 ounces of shampoo on a flight tomorrow, flights would be no more dangerous then. The limit was bullcrap. The ease with which the TSA can toss it aside makes it clear. All over America, the coronavirus is revealing, or at least reminding us, just how much of a contemporary American life is bullcrap, with power structures built on punishment and fear as opposed to our best interests. Whenever the government or corporation benevolently withdraws some punitive threat because of the coronavirus, it's a signal that there was never any good reason for that threat to exist in the first place. Each day of the public health crisis brings a new example. People thrown in jail for minor offenses? San Antonio is one of the many jurisdictions to announce that to keep jails from being crowded with sick citizens, they will stop doing that. Why were we doing it in the first place? The federal government changing interest on loans to attend college? Well, Donald Trump has instructed government agencies to administer loans to waive interest accrual for the duration of the crisis. But why on earth was our government charging its own citizens' interest anyway? Broadband data caps and throttled internet? Those that have been eliminated by TNT and other internet service providers because of the coronavirus. But data caps and throttling were really just veiled price hikes that served no real technical purpose. Why did we put up with them? Police helping landlords evict tenants in times of financial trouble? Due to the coronavirus, not anymore in New York, Miami, or New Orleans. But you see where this is going. Why do the police aid evictions when tenants are stricken with other non-coronavirus illnesses? The city shutting off your water or the power as punishment for your hardships? During this public health emergency, plenty of cities and companies have suddenly found a way to keep service turned on. Quote, as long as COVID-19 remains a health concern, said the Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan, no Detroit resident should have concerns about whether their water service will be interrupted. Why in the hell should any Detroit resident have concerns about their water service being interrupted ever? Shouldn't clean water be the absolute base level of service delivered by a city to its residents? If you didn't know, thousands of residents in Detroit have had their water shut off because of their non-ability to pay. After all the jobs have been outsourced and all of the money has been pumped out of it, all the value extracted. Sick employees forced to take unpaid leave or work while sick if you want to keep your jobs? Walmart recently announced it would provide up to 2 weeks of paid leave for any employee who contracts the coronavirus. and the House just passed a bill to address the problem. Though, as the New York Times editorial board notes, the House is failing to make the bill universal, quoting them, is an embarrassment that endangers the health of workers, consumers, and the broader American public. Man, I wish I had the New York Times on my side when we were fighting for paid sick leave here in Albany County and the rest of New York State. But why should any sick worker fear losing their pay or their job at any time? And why are the most vulnerable to punitive sick leave practices the workers making the lowest wages? In every single one of these cases, it's not just the most of these practices are accepted as standard, it's that they are a way to punish people, to make lives more difficult, or to make sure that the money keeps, and this is key, the money keeps flowing upward. Up until now, activists and customers have been meant to believe that the powers that be could never change these policies. It would be too expensive, too unwieldy, or would simply upset the way things are done. But now, faced suddenly with an environment in which we're all supposed to at least appear to be focused on the common good, the rulemakers have decided it's okay to suspend them. It's a crisis, after all. Everyone's got to do their part. So what will happen when the crisis passes? Yes, it's worth asking yourself now in the early days of this pandemic how you might change your behavior individually, but what temporary adjustments in your lifestyle you might adopt permanently in the aftertimes. Whether that's working from home, because all these jobs where, oh, you couldn't work at home, you got to come in. No, no, no. It's about surveillance. It's about managing you as a worker. Get real. You could have always worked at home. It was always a lie. Or maybe cutting back on your airline travel. But it's also worth asking if we are allowing, willing to allow governments and corporations to return to business as usual. Now, this is the opportunity of real system change, people. It's always when there's this dropping of the threats, you know, the raising of expectations, that maybe we could have these things in place all the time. Why not? What give the please, powerful people, please, people, the billionaires, please, the people, the think tanks, tell us why in a way that isn't circular reasoning. When everything's back to normal, will we accept cities cutting off their poorest residents' water or evicting the sick or throwing someone in jail because they can't afford to pay a fine? I want to say that once a policy is revealed as bullcrap, it gets a lot harder to convince smart, engaged citizens to capitulate to it. That's one reason why activists are agitating to end cash bail in the coronavirus crisis or fighting to ensure that coronavirus tests and other eventual vaccine is available to all. Not only would those measures save, or better, countless lives during the pandemic, but in the common sense wisdom, they expose the absurdity of the opposing view. What kind of ghoul would argue that we shouldn't vaccinate everyone against a pandemic threatening the health of our nation? It's the same kind of ghoul, perhaps, who thinks that cancer treatment or insulin should only be available for those lucky enough to be able to pay for it. In a time of real anxiety, maybe this optimism is just grasping for something good to come of all this. But that's really up to us. Over the next few weeks, we're going to see more and more absurd or cruel or counterproductive practices revealed. Pay attention when they are. Notice the statements the people in charge make when they effortlessly roll back their surcharges and threats, their punishments and impediments. Remember them. And when the time comes that the danger of the virus is no longer as severe, and those people try to quietly reinstate the policies that hurt so many around you, remember, for a lot of Americans, a return to normal is a scary prospect. Keep your giant bottle of hand sanitizer. You're going to need to deal with all the bullcrap that's coming back when the pandemic finally passes. So that was Dan Coyes from writing either for Slate or published by Slate. Now, the other half of railing against the system and capitalism, that was the stick approach, railing against the stick, right? That, you know, you work for wages so you can pay your rent. So the landowner or the landlord can pay the mortgage on the property to the bank. And the bank doesn't really have to pay back anyone except other banks. And then they all kind of circle jerk themselves. with billions of dollars to each other. Shutting down the economy stops the flow of money upwards. You know, it's slowing the carbon emissions. It's slowing the inequality just for a month or so. We'll see how long this goes. You know, we're going into martial law territory. I was asking on an anarchist page, if it's state order, right? But if it's still the right thing to do to self-quarantine and whatever, you know, are anarchists still going to do that? And I got one response. Basically, it's like, we're going to do what it takes to save lives. Very blanket approach. But it's the right answer, too. It was a good answer. Good enough for me. Because otherwise, sometimes I kind of see contradictions. As you we'll see later, or, you know, if I get to it. If you look up mutual aid networks, you can see that. But let's go through this piece from Common Dreams, published by Common Dreams, written by Simon Springer. Now, again, so maybe I should just give an expletive warning. I say bull crap because crap is not something censored by the FCC. But the word shit is. So if you're, maybe I'll apologize in advance or, you know, just give a trigger warning. You know, the word shit is used quite a bit in this article. I'm going to replace it with crap. Okay. Toilet paper wars and the crap house of capitalism. Actually, it has a better ring to it. So there's something else from, again, I start my mornings with a video from Zero Books. And this time they talked about relating toilet paper, Joe Biden, and ideology. How? Okay. So the ideology of our times is not so much, it doesn't matter what you believe. It kind of matters what other people believe. And there's always this hypothetical other people that believe that we need to evict people who can't pay their rent, or that people need to pay for services that they need. You know, and then they have to work for it, and that we sort of have a safety net for those that can't, but that's always being cut and restricted. And if you actually talk to someone on disability, you'll kind of find they're still in trouble. And that's really not enough, especially because their needs are severe and more than just, what, $500 rent and $200 for food. You know, that's disability check is like $800. I think even for a single person like me, my monthly expenses are $1,000 at least. But anyway, the general point was other people believe it. Just like how with the run on toilet paper, it wasn't so much people started panic buying because there was a rumor that other people were panic buying. And either you're thinking that that's the smart move and I need to do it too, or I need to do it before they buy up all the toilet paper. Otherwise, I'll be left with none. Our entire political system operates the same way. Take Biden, for example. It's not so much that people like Biden, or it actually has policy or a platform, that even Trump now is out-lefting him, at least in rhetoric, whether it's implemented or not. But freezing evictions is a very left-wing thing to do, because, you know, it hurts capital, it hurts landlords. But then you freeze mortgages, so then landlords aren't hurt, and then banks need to freeze their interest, so they're not charging each other for their massive business. They're a business. But it's other people that believe that Biden is the right person to be Trump. Either hypothetical moderates, or it's the leadership. Yeah, it's even if you ask Democratic leadership, it's like it's other people that believe that Biden's the right choice. Everyone, it's always someone else that believes Biden's the right choice. Now, there are a minority, you could find them, who believe Biden is in fact the right person to be Trump. But they are a minority. They are not enough to win the election. Okay? Know what numbers you're looking at, whatever. So Joe Biden is the toilet paper candidate. But that goes for the entire system and ourselves. It really doesn't matter what you believe. It matters what other people believe. Capitalists believe that we need to grow exponentially, so we're going to do that. And that means you have to believe it too, because you have to pay them to live in the society. That's what capitalism means, okay? It's not market economics. It's not property rights. It is a matter of who controls wealth and power. And that's bankers and capitalists. Brings it down just to the power and authority level. Because who has authority, right? It's not God. If you're religious, it's God. But for a lot of Americans, it's not. We're non-religious, or we act like we're not religious. And authority, at least politically speaking, okay? Not cosmically, politically. Authority is just someone else believes it's important. But let's find those people. Oh, you can't? then what are we basing our belief systems on? Okay, let's go into this. The crap house of capitalism. The run on toilet paper has brought the failings of capitalism front and center to the bathroom of every house across Australia. This guy's writing from there, I guess. A trend that has now spread to other countries. We are witnessing in real time and with stunning consequence the stone cold fact that markets are an ineffective mediator of resources, prone to the worst vagaries of herd mentality. Perceived impending shortages of toilet paper owing in the spread of COVID-19 set off widespread panic. We might be inclined to laugh at the impossibility of the whole scenario, but whether the situation is real or imagined is beside the point. The truth, which is this case, may appear stranger than fiction, is that markets operate in the sweet spot between scarcity and fear. So this piece here is a general critique of market economics within capitalism. Strong case that's like, don't call it free markets because they're not free in any way. They're highly regulated by capitalists. Socialist market would be freer. Those who stockpile toilet paper are in no danger of running out, and many undoubtedly have way more rolls than they could ever hope to use in the course of several months. These individuals have successfully avoided catastrophe while stuffing up their fellow citizens in the process. The whole situation is quite literally a stinking mess. What is particularly tragic, though, is that this story of scarcity and hoarding is a common one. It is a story of capitalism itself. Let's pretend that we are talking about housing rather than toilet paper for a moment. So it's using our the direct experience of recently. So to better understand how the housing market fails us and it's terrible, and market economics for necessities is a bad idea. It's using the more direct short-term case of the toilet paper to then talk about housing and housing scarcity, to explain homelessness and the housing crisis, because that's a slower crisis. Those who got into the property market early or have the ability to enter into the housing market at this stage are the big winners. By early, we are talking several generations ago, when land was cheaper and people were far fewer. It was a time when savvy buyers could accumulate vast portfolios. The payoffs is that their children and grandchildren had to do very little to maintain the wealth that they inherited, other than continuing to extract value in the form of rent from the properties they owned. This is Donald Trump's story, and it is one of the extreme privilege of an exploitation. His critics have often appalled by his lack of empathy, but Trump appears to have no conception of caring for the poor precisely because he doesn't have to. In a similar fashion, if you have a good stockpile of toilet paper, you're likely not so worried about what everyone else in your neighborhood might be doing. You're just looking out for number one, so you can continue to do your number twos in peace. Much like the run on toilet paper produced winners and losers by creating a situation of scarcity, so too does the housing market have the same effect. Few can afford housing precisely because there has been a decades long run on this commodity. The extension of the time scale makes it less obvious as to what is going on, but it is the exact same mechanism at play. Those who got into housing first have nothing to fear. They are not prone to the uncertainties that plague the experiences of those who have lost out. Insecurity often comes in the form of inflated prices. While there have been examples of people trying to sell toilet paper at exorbitant prices on eBay, so far the demand has not matched sellers' exploitative expectations. Yay for that. Housing is another matter, where those who did not get in early must pay inflated prices, subject themselves to an ongoing extraction of their means in the form of rent, or find themselves homeless or houseless. The fact that there are fistfights in grocery stores is the tip of the iceberg in terms of the desperation that a populace can express when placed in the context of crisis. Violence becomes inevitable, which is a terrifying thought when we recognize that housing is a systemic crisis. On the one hand, people turning on each other is a reflection of an individualist society. See the earlier rant that I began the show with, that we are forced to compete with each other on a global scale. We have to compete as individuals because we're competing as a nation against other nations. The poor seldom form solidarities that encourage them to turn on their oppressors by organizing events like rent strikes. They are too busy fighting each other over scraps to make ends meet. Who does hoarding hurt? The answer should be clear. Whether in housing or in toilet paper, it is poor and working families living paycheck to paycheck who are worst affected. They can't afford to stock up on commodities like toilet paper because they are continually paying rent so that they can have access to the most basic and yet most hoarded commodity of all, that of housing. The toilet paper apocalypse is already prompting people to reconsider their strategies for managing their bodily needs in ways that do not fall prey to the further hoarding, paying of ransoms, or resorting to violence. There is, for example, a lot of discussion on social media about the benefits of bidets. I mentioned this last week. While responding to a shortage of toilet paper might seem trivial in the grand scheme of capitalism, it has provided us with a small glimpse into what it means to explore other ways of being. In the context of housing, such experimentation comes in the form of co-ops, intergenerational living arrangements, and even housing squats. There is a key difference between toilet paper and housing, though. Toilet paper shortages are unlikely to be a prolonged phenomenon. The boom will soon bust. Major retailers have already begun placing limits on the amount of people can buy. So that's what a regulated market looks like. You know, instead of dealing, you know, thinking of things as scarcity and hoarding and first adopter, you know, situations, you simply ration to ensure that everyone gets what they need. Sound like something else? They have intervened in the market, recognizing that any supposed invocation of it being free is a dystopian fantasy that is detrimental to the community as a whole. The housing situation, on the other hand, is a protracted affair, and one that leaves many people out in the cold. It is not going to fix itself, and successive governments all around the world have proven that they are unwilling to regulate in ways that are equitable. In the face of such effectuality and inequality, the question then becomes, how much crap are people willing to take? Simon Springer is a professor of human geography and is the head of discipline for geography and environmental studies for the University of Newcastle in Australia. That was from Common Dreams. And now related to that, a story from LA. Homeless families in Los Angeles has seized housing, announced plans to seize more properties in the future. Now, this article is from the People's Voice. This is Maoists in America. You know, they exist. They're not big. But so along with coverage of this story, which can be found elsewhere, this group seizing houses and squatting in them, because in order to self-quarantine, you kind of need a house. And but it's also this is also going to include kind of the Maoist position and the Maoist point of view. And I figure it's worth sharing to remind ourselves of all the different vectors of action. I'm gonna go with that. So this was published last week, but it's, you know, it's ongoing. Saturday morning saw an escalation in revolutionary housing struggle in California. Homeless families, inspired by the success for Moms for Housing in Oakland, after a sharp struggle, reproduced the tactic and seized control of a house. Now I saw another story that said they have seized 12, which is much more impressive and what makes more sense. I don't think it's a big story. Just do one. They did 12. But a house in El Sereno. The LA Times reports, so you can check the LA Times for the story. They said 12. They report that they seek to spread the tactic to new properties in the future. So maybe this was written when they did one, and of course they seized another 11. This development comes on the heels of orders to self-quarantine. Naturally, homeless people cannot self-quarantine because they have no homes. Quoting, "I'm a mother of two daughters. I need a home," says Martha Escurendo, 42, who has spent the last 18 months living on couches with friends and family members in neighborhoods across East LA. Quote, quoting her again, "There are these homes that are vacant and they belong to the community." Simple. Escurendo and her family moved to the house with Ruby Gongreno, 33, and Gordillo's three children. The Gordillos have been living in a small studio in Pico Union. Joining the two families in the El Sereno home is Benito Flores, 64, a welder who has been living in his van. Like the Moms for Homeless group in Oakland, the protesters in LA are receiving assistance from the Alliance of Californians for Community Empowerment, an organizing group that's advocated for state measures to expand rent control and other tenant protections. So they're like a housing coalition, housing rights coalition, that lobbies the government, but has the budget to provide legal aid and perhaps act as a mediator for the seizing of these homes. Because that is how one does it. You can squat individually, but that's not a movement and that's not empowerment, because you're really just kind of hiding out. To do it with an organization behind you, that's empowerment. As the interview shows, the homeless are by and large working class people and semi-proletarians, they're workers, who have been priced out of their historic neighborhoods across the country. So I'm going to back up and explain. The word proletarian, which comes up in, you know, socialist jargon all the time, it's referring to a worker that is being like exploited and disempowered. It's a disempowered worker. At least that's my interpretation. There are likely others. Anyway, these are people who've been priced out of their historic neighborhoods across the country by so-called urban renewal, and what can be more accurately be called worker removal. In many cases, the neighborhoods are bulldozed and cleared for gentrification and redevelopment purposes. This process has been going on for decades. Like the other one said, housing stockpiling. Targeting and clearing black and brown working class neighborhoods as slums and destroying them. Naturally, this leads to large numbers of housing insecure or outright homeless people. In the middle of the COVID-19 pandemic, this becomes even more a matter of literal life or death, though of course it was before. The property that was rightfully seized by the masses, referring to these community members, is owned by the state of California. It's already public property. State and local governments routinely buy up or take over large amounts of property and allow them to remain vacant when redevelopment plans fall through, which is often. The city of St. Louis wiped the black city of Kinloch off the map in this manner. So now a little bit of history. Quoting something, neoliberalism had its day in Kinloch in the 1980s. The city of St. Louis, which owns Lambert St. Louis International Airport, literally bought most of the city's land and razed it to the ground. Generations of work put in by new African hands were wiped out by bulldozers and wrecking balls for a proposed airport expansion that never came, displacing thousands of people. The vast majority of them ended up in neighboring, formerly white people-dominated towns such as Florissant, Berkeley, and Ferguson. Now, I use New African, which is a jargon, Maoist jargon word for, or left-wing one, for African-Americans. Because the rhetoric goes that they're really not treated as Americans. They're not full Americans. Black people have never been treated as full Americans. Just ask one. They don't belong. But you can call them better framing is to just call them New Africans. This occupation is an example. So here's where the Maoist point of view comes in. But of course, it's direct action. There's anarchists and other tendency framings of seizing the means, right? It's just the socialist thing, seizing the means. But how you seize the means. But okay, it's an example of the Maoist dictum, or socialist dictum, that the masses are fully capable of taking steps for their own well-being. They did not ask permission or seek to go through the courts in the beginning. They saw an empty house and they took it for their well-being. This is the demonstration of what Mao said regarding the masses being the true heroes. We are often childish and foolish, referring to managers. While the left engages in positional wrecking warfare against itself, repeats the same old tiled arguments, or engages in electoral centrism, the people, rather, displaced and marginal people, display heroism and courage. This shows from where the revolution comes. In the midst of the pandemic, mutual aid networks are mobilizing or being formed. They're securing needed hygiene and food supplies and delivering them to individuals in quarantine. Revolutionary organizations are conducting political education around the causes of this pandemic, the response in countries such as Cuba and Venezuela compared to the U.S., and mobilizing the masses around revolutionary worker demands that originate from their conditions. The demands, and this is basically just Maoist theory. So here are the demands for their political organization, the FTP, or the FTP movement led by the MCP, which is, I guess, Maoist Communist Party. But their demands are very similar to any other left-wing organization, including the Green Party. 1, eviction and rent freeze. 2, public utility shutoff freeze. 3, universal paid sick leave. 4, free testing and treatment. So universal health care, whether it be socialized or Medicare for all. 5, free food and other necessities for all in quarantine. Just provide it, as Vietnam is doing. 6, immediate release of those being held in jail on cash bond and closing all courts for the duration of the emergency. Immediate compassionate release for immunocompromised and elderly prisoners in light of their increased risk for contraction and death from COVID-19. Yes, release the prisoners. What is an old person who's been sentenced to life going to do, you know? We support all direct actions of a housing and material nature and encourage their spread, along with the development of revolutionary coalitions and people's councils, that's direct democracy stuff, which administer the provision of material support for occupiers, meaning of homes. Not occupiers like the police state. Our occupation of homes. The involvement of people's self-defense organizations like the Coalition for Armed Labor. Yes, they exist. So is a socialist right association. Yes. Working in conjunction with legal collectives like the National Lawyers Guild to ensure the legal and physical defense of space seized by the masses. So this is about making a legal argument that if the state is going to leave a house vacant, that there is a community need, a social welfare, a general welfare need. So you can even make constitutional arguments, you know, provide for the general welfare. Well, the general welfare means we house people. And that means if the state owns property, that property should be provided for housing. And the development of a tactical unity between revolutionary organizations around the slogan, as many are, housing is a human right. Don't ask for it, take it. This is not just the demonstration of revolutionary principles in practice, but the learning of warfare through warfare. These struggles will escalate and spread in the future and is essential to struggle for leadership of this. These are the struggles that build our empowerment, and we must immerse ourselves in them. So that's a more Maoist point of view, but you know, it's got a bunch of other stuff in there too. But the general, of course, this is just around the story of homeless families in LA are squatting, but in an organized fashion. A former Greenpeace presidential candidate, Sherry Honkala, did the same thing in Philadelphia about a decade ago, and of course still does so today. Organizes around the homeless and for housing for all, and housing as a right. Okay, this message goes out to the Capital District or the Albany that's listening. There is a mutual aid network set up in the South End. There is a General Capital District COVID-19 mutual aid volunteer sign up on Facebook that's being shared around. Mutual aid network simply works as like so. They're coordinators, the people who create the page or the list. You sign up with your skills and what you have to offer, or what your needs are. Let's say you are quarantined, you're actually sick, and you really are not going to go out even for shopping. Then you need someone to bring groceries to you, or some extra food. Then, say someone who is available to make deliveries, then makes deliveries. This is a way of making sure that people getting their needs met isn't a matter of chance. I think I saw a Facebook post that was kind of the, you know, God bless, where they were looking for essentials, even at gas stations, and someone who was delivering meals for the school district. So the school district of Albany, we're going to provide school lunches to be picked up by any family. But very few came the first day they did this. Because, well, they're quarantining, they're staying at home, they don't want to come out, or they really just aren't able to. They got their other crap to deal with. So the school district has now, all the workers are delivering the meals to the families, either on the free school lunch program or anyone who requests it. So one of them had extras at the end of their rounds, I suppose, I'm assuming. And they gave this mother them, and it was a good exchange. And the fact that they learned from, like, they did something one day, and then they changed what they were going to do, and not just say, you know, just blame people, like, oh, why aren't they coming out? They know they want their food. A lesser community wouldn't do the deliveries. They just assume, like the mindset of, like, anti-democracy of, like, well, if people don't want to be informed, they can just go to hell. If they don't want to pick up their food, then I guess they don't want it. They don't really need it. No, that's not the case at all, because you may know better. So otherwise, thank you very much. Where are we at? Okay, still have 2 minutes. I guess I will I'll play the other piece of music I have, which is also Weird Al.
I really wanna be alone, but that's one state I'm never in, because I know that I've got millions upon millions of tiny one-celled organisms living on my skin. I rub and scrub until my flesh is raw and bleeding, but they just come right back. Sleep. That's when they start their sneak attack. In the morning, I wake up in utter horror to find my teeth are covered with bacterial plaque. Can't get those parasitic creatures off my face. And there's more coming every day.
All right. I'm Dan Platt. Welcome back to the Three Left Show in the second hour, talking about the pandemic and our leftist reactions to it, various types of reactions. Here's a general socialist one for you. Just simply, what is socialism? It's worker-controlled means of production. To put it in one mouthful. But it's basically a citizen and community control of our economic destiny. When Trump talks of that the government should own part of the companies and industries that it bails out, that is pseudo-socialist principles. It's amazing. Now, of course, this is just Trump being Trump. He says things. What actually happens is, of course, usually a big lie. But still, at least in rhetoric, in the conversation, in the Overton window, I think there was a... Oh, yeah, it was Matt Taibbi that just didn't like using the word Overton window. Whatever. But from this was from Left Voice. No place better. And it's simply, workers' control of production is the emergency measure we need. And by the way, this does in fact cover what the federal government is proposing or doing or planning on doing or whatever. It's all quite, what the hell is really going on. But here is the message of this piece. There is only one way to ensure that all the different emergency measures being enacted to combat the coronavirus pandemic serve the interests of the working class and not the capitalists, whose primary motivation is to rescue their corrupt, inhumane economic system. And that is workers' control, which can also be termed as community control. But community can be abstract. You know, the city government calls itself a community when it jails people. We're protecting the community. So community is a bit more abstract. Workers, you know, it's a little more grounded. Like, of course, workers, the people that are still doing the deliveries, the providing the essential services, the healthcare workers, my job, which is in homeless services. My schedule has not really changed at all. The man-child president who spent weeks telling people in the U.S. that the coronavirus was nothing to worry about, that it was a hoax or a plot by the news media to undermine his presidency, and who looked it right into the TV cameras on multiple occasions and lied about the number of cases and the availability of tests, claimed on March 17th, quote, "It felt it was a pandemic long before. I felt it was a pandemic long before it was called a pandemic." His usual shtick. Now Donald Trump, whose father bought him a doctor's diagnosis to avoid military service during the Vietnam War, who claimed to know more about military strategy than generals, and who has tried to have a giant parade in his honor with tanks and missiles on flatbed trucks, gets a wish granted. He gets to call himself a wartime president. This came as part of his announcement that he was invoking the 1950 Defense Production Act, established to allow the government to shift factory output to war needs during the Korean War. Hey, remember that? It was when we leveled a country. It was a codification, making into a law, that was the U.S. government did, of what the U.S. government did during the Second World War, when it sent women into idle factories. Male workers have been largely sent to Europe or the Pacific to fight, to make airplanes, guns, ammunition, and other military needs. Trump's executive order states that the government will use the act to obtain health and medical resources needed to respond to the spread of a COVID-19, including personal protective equipment and ventilators. He sounds so dead during his broadcast. I mean, it's just like he's like, I never wanted to do this. Ugh. This makes you think the U.S. government is nationalizing factories as part of a response to fighting the virus. Think again. Just as with regular war, there's plenty of profit to be made by the capitalists. Under capitalism, all war means profit, whether it's on disease, war on poverty, war on terror. Now, an explanation. The Defense Production Act, DPA, has three main sections. In the priorities and allocations section, the DPA gives the president authority to require corporations to accept and prioritize contracts for services and materials deemed necessary. The expansion of productive capacity and supply section, second one, allows the president to create incentives. Incentives. So that comes up in policy a lot. Definitely not socialist policy. For industry to produce critical materials. And the third one, general provisions, establish government authority to come to agreements with private industry and to create a volunteer group of industry executives who could be called to government service. Now, when you fuse the state and corporations for their mutual benefit with agreements and contracts, that has a certain name. What could it be? Let's put those all together. Other than stipulating what factories produce, perhaps that GM plant near you is going to start making ventilators. But this is pretty much business as usual. The government will issue contracts. That is, they'll use your tax dollars to pay for the goods produced. Those contracts will have incentives for cooperation and participation, meaning, you know, more like money on the side, and participation in production of whatever the government deems necessary. And a group of leading capitalists will be sitting at the table making the decisions. So, you know, has power shifted at all? No. And of course, at the end, it's the logic of capitalism that will, the rules, the belief in it. But what could go wrong with this? It's not like factory owners will be making some kind of national sacrifice, lest you think this is some kind of nationalization. Their ownership and profit making are insured. They'll be able to keep some workers employed, but you can bet that they'll be petitioning the government for further stipulations, you know, incentives, allowing them to lower wages, benefits, and other protections. After all, this is a national emergency, and the DPA also authorizes the president to impose wage controls and settle labor disputes. No striking or organizing for you. Which side do you think Trump will come down on in the confrontation between workers and the bosses? If the bars were open, there could be a new drinking game. Take a shot every time one of Trump's cronies gets a government DPA contract. So while we definitely need to be on the war footing, meaning nationalizing all health care and the production efforts needed to ensure we have the supplies and capacity we need at this dire time, so that was meant by a World War II type mobilization. That's usually the rhetoric in Green New Deal. This needs to be done under democratic control by workers / communities. This executive order is not that. Dire stakes. On March 18th, the New York Times reported that the Fed had shown its reporters a 100-page plan that lays out the grim prognosis. Maybe you've heard of this. For a pandemic that will last 18 months or longer, coming in multiple waves, it predicts widespread shortages that will strain consumers and the U.S. healthcare system. In addition to the shortages of medical equipment, the DPA declaration is aimed at addressing. It draws attention to, quote, impacts to lifelines at state and local levels, including food, fuel, transportation. You know, the supply chain will be disrupted. And that's what everyone's really afraid of. You know, you stockpile now because if it's disrupted in the next few months, yeah, then you can't even go to the grocery store. Which, of course, are profit-making machines as well. Though they're responding to community demands for, say, elderly hours, which is, I don't know, I guess it backfired because I saw a local supermarket that did that and they had a line going around the store. I guess they only had one cashier. I weep for that cashier. The plan also says state and local governments, as well as critical infrastructure and communication channels, will be stressed and potentially less reliable. I'm reading this very dryly, but I could be in a kind of panicked voice as well. These stresses may also increase the challenges of getting updated messages, you know, communication, coordinating guidance in these jurisdictions directly. Is this what causes America to balkanize? In other words, the government is projecting that even the channel on which you're reading this article on Facebook or the web may become unavailable or severely compromised, along with radio, TV, phone systems. Well, maybe not national radio, maybe not community radio. That's why program manager Paul and me and others view this station as a just as essential service as others. Marxists call for the nationalization of industries because this step aims at organizing and rationalizing, meaning make sense, production in the interests of the societal good and not for the purpose of making personal profit. Public ownership of essential services, healthcare, education, transit, for instance, are particularly important because access to such services is critical to human life and should not be governed by market forces. Why not? See the previous hour where we talked about toilet paper and housing. In a life or death crisis, nationalization takes on new meaning and urgency. This is talking as a socialist. We need what Trump's invocation of the TPA aims to deliver. Much needed medical materials that are in short supply. But there is nothing to be gained by the working class, you know, or middle class in the capitalistic approach, which is centered on ensuring that workers' labor can still be exploited to be make money for the bosses. What changes our situation is not what we produce, but how that work is organized, how it's done. Yes to radical measures to fight this virus, but working people must hold the reins. So this is an invocation of kind of where, how the left should be talking publicly, right? What is our propaganda efforts supposed to look like when Trump is doing pseudo-nationalizing, right? But of course it isn't, as this article, as this piece says. I agree completely that, you know, let's see, there was a concern that the populist right were going to outflank the left with on economics. Now, if the left refers to the Democratic Party and Joe Biden, then yeah, that's what's happening, okay? Because the proper left, the left that I am part of, we don't have our own mass national party. To do that, you need to vote green so we get 5% nationally in the country. If we reach 5%, then we are a national party. And that's where the real third-party, alternative party building gets to happen. All right. It's not happening now because we don't have a national left-wing party. Green Party gets 5% of the vote, then we're on our way. And then all those other progressive groups can sign on, and then we can have a coalition where, oh man, it's going to be a mess of a discussion about our platform. But because right now it's very much socialist. It calls for nationalizing in the way that this article calls for, where it is worker control, that we are creating massive co-ops, cooperatives, worker ownership, worker control, worker management. Don't believe they can do it? Of course they could do it. Just talk to people on line floors. They know how to do their job. They know how to organize it. And one of them can talk to the other departments of the company or the firm. You know, a neutral term for company is to use the word firm. Okay, so here's so I got two more stories, more or less. So this is from Hood Communist. I meant to read something from them in a previous show, but now it's time for the other. The other one was about Bernie Sanders and imperialism. But this one's better. This is from a new African perspective, Hood Communist. Don't let panic force you to support a growing fascist police state. So here's to another type of concern. Rightfully concerned about what is happening and what could result from this crisis. You know, we're kind of like, we're all stuck and stopped. You know, stopping everything is the right thing to do. So then it becomes, what do we fight for? What is the fight? You know, when, like, the second that the quarantine is over and the, you know, and we've, let's say we prevented the massive spike of cases that, you know, we flattened the curve. We successfully flattened the curve, right? I think I'm going to make like a undefined date, but like, you know, the second it's over, we should go march. March for what? Well, that's what I'm talking about. It could be a march against the growth of a fascist state and fascism, which is a combination of state and corporation I was referring to, for fighting a war. But a war against what? Well, the war on this virus can quickly become a war on the poor, as it is every day. So this is from Ajamu Ume, if I got that name right. I probably don't. It's important to contextualize what's happening throughout the world today with the challenges facing us from the potential growth of COVID-19. If what we are learning is true, this virus has devastating capacity. Even if you are healthy and strong, you can hold the virus without knowing it for up to 14 days incubation. During that time, you can unknowingly pass a virus onto countless people who do not have the benefit of a strong immunity system. This is an unprecedented element that forced me to start thinking isolation, despite the fact I'm really not concerned about the virus as it relates to impacting my body. Same for me. Those are obviously real concerns. It's also worth repeating that millions of colonized and oppressed people across the world are forced daily to live under martial law conditions. Empty shelves at stores, restricted movement, lack of food and health care. In countries like Zimbabwe, Iran, Cuba, and Venezuela, these stark conditions result in large part due to U.S.-led capitalist economic sanctions against them for refusing to toe capitalism line. In other parts of the world, the exploitation of nature and the domination of production of goods and services by capitalists continues to maintain the system of very few haves and millions of have-nots. All of the above is connected to the real anxiety about COVID-19 in the U.S. and other capitalist countries. Consistent with what these imperial nations do to colonized countries as daily policy, their approach to addressing the challenge of this virus are led with the military, guns first strategy. Meanwhile, in socialist Cuba, despite having extremely limited resources due to the 58-year-old blockade against them by our government, they are leading the way in confronting the virus. They have worked with China to develop a vaccine using antiviral medication called interferon. The medication works with the body's natural proteins to formulate a boost to the body's own immunity system, because it is more about fighting the symptoms of the virus while our body is able to fight it. Cuba has shared the medication with China and virus epicenters like Italy. In fact, Cuba has sent dozens of doctors to Italy to help treat the virus there. So it's China. That's what international solidarity looks like instead of competition. Is the U.S. sending doctors anywhere? Well, in the Red Cross or Doctors Without Borders, that's the case, but not the government. We don't even have the capacity to do that. We don't even have like the infrastructure for that. We've cut our capacity to do that instead. The U.S., with its profit over people dedication, has been forced to announce that the medical resources to adequately treat the virus do not presently exist within this country. And that is the true crime, by the way. That is the, if you to be outraged about anything, and you know, why are we outraged at capitalism, the system? It's because it has not provided the means to actually defend ourselves. The reason for the total lockdown, okay, is because here in New York, we don't even have the ability to test for it. We have run out of tests. We have to make more. How long will that take? We have to wait for the DPA to kick in. It's amazing how unprepared our system is. Healthcare, production, whatever. Again, because we kept hospitals keep the number of respirators low because, you know, they don't want to have too much of a surplus around because, you know, it costs money. It costs something to have a surplus, to actually have enough. To have a scarcity means you can charge more. It means you can make more money. It's criminal, I tell you. It's criminal. Consequently, the focus on martial law, social distancing, curfews, etc., the lip service is being given to providing finances to working people. Again, at the moment, it's just lip service. Some of that may happen or not, but you can bet on corporations, especially large ones, being bailed out with your tax dollars. They get bailed out, we get sold out. While all of this is happening, this military-first approach is setting the stage for intensified police-state realities. Because the question remains, it's been called here in New York that starting Sunday night, full outside, you'll be fined if you're actually outside or, you know, and then it's a question of like, well, if you are going to your needed job, do you need a work pass? How will this be enforced? How, you know, there aren't that many policemen, okay? Are people going to be conscripted to enforce this stuff? No, if you ask me, I think social pressure is enough. That's my answer. But again, peer pressure is enough. But what the enforcement angle was for is the focus on will be suddenly turned on people looting toilet paper or even food, and the resources of the state will be loaded up towards stopping people from getting what they need, not ensuring that they have medical and human resources they deserve. It's important that in the midst of this, we all don't fall victim to the push to support such a police state. The stage is set for the empire's us-against-them mentality of othering people who don't fit, whether they be colonized people, LGBTQ, the poor, the homeless, the houseless. It's these populations who are most vulnerable right now. Please accept that under any circumstances, the police and the police state are not your friends. Under no circumstance does it benefit you, your family, your country, for you to talk to police about anything, not even about the weather. And this is the general ANCAP approach. CAB. If the virus intensifies as expected, panic will increase. In their consistent efforts to do everything in their power to ensure we remain afraid of each other, so that we never focus on the super rich who are really responsible for all these problems, we can see things much more drastically. We can see things becoming much more drastic. During these increasingly difficult times, it's going to be crucial that people don't allow themselves to become unwitting snitches for state-sponsored repression. Establish electronic ways of keeping in touch with people around you that you trust on networks, you know, phone tree, even if they aren't in your immediate vicinity. Maintain social contact and stay aware of breaking developments. Ensure those developments are communicated clearly across your network. Establish checks, check-ins to compare notes. Be social even as we socially isolate. And that is where radio can become a great tool. Talk to people you know who may be more vulnerable to police terror. People who have issues happening like outstanding warrants need to be help establishing a regimen that permits them to lay low. Don't drive around with expired driver's licenses or vehicle registration. If you have to go out, and by the way, this is just general stuff about resisting the police state. If you have to go out for anything extended, all right, try to make sure someone knows where you're going. And of course, always observe all the frequently mentioned practices to prevent the spread of this virus. Okay, so CDC guidelines. When I mention them at work, you know, it's like, you believe them? Like, you gotta believe somebody to some extent. And if it's immunologists, then yes. Washing your hands, maintaining a 6 feet distance, these are fine. All right. You don't have to be an authoritarian to do these things. And even exert social pressure like, yeah, we should all stay home. Let's not all break curfew for the sake of being outraged. We can wait until maybe not for the state to say so, but after, if 2 weeks pass, right, and the spike of cases and those that are sick, we flatten the curve, you know, that's when we go like, okay, are you gonna drop the curfew? Are you going to drop the state of emergency? And then it's a question of, well, if they don't, then we need to be in the streets. And if they do, okay. Then we also fight to extend the sick leave, the eviction ban. You know, should always go to mediation when it comes to tenants, landlords, and landlords and banks, right? Because the hierarchy just keeps going up till you get to what? An abstract idea of profit making. Finally, don't ever forget that the capitalist system is the core reason behind the situation. I provide the example of Cuba because their socialist developments clearly illustrate that there are many effective ways to serve and protect humanity when people come first. The fact people aren't first in capitalism contributes to conditions where a virus can grow out of control. So, capitalism is at fault. Even just based on that reality, not to mention the fact that we don't know where or who the creation of this virus can be attributed to, but we do know, and by the way, I am not, he relates to, he's not making any statement here. He's just saying, I'm just saying, capitalist countries have a history of producing viruses and other biowarfare weapons. I'll leave it at that. And despite the fact, because like stability, okay, they're not going to willfully destabilize everything. They're, you know, the stocks are dropping. Some are winning. Some are losing. Some billionaires are winning. Some billionaires are losing. They all don't know what they're doing. You know, there's not one plan. Okay. I'm not that kind of conspiracy guy. That's why talking about capitalism itself as a general system, not a plan, right? It's the fact that it's all unplanned. Like we had no plan. That's why it's a crisis. Last paragraph. And despite the fact your loved ones may be police or military, or you may be yourself, the undisputed reality is that these armed and trained state institutions like police and military are here for one purpose, to protect the interests of the system itself. They are not here to protect and serve you, and that's been legally defined, and the proof of that is borne out by the fact that they are being deployed to control your movements, not to distribute food. You don't employ armed, trained mercenaries to distribute food. Any of us can do that. You deploy them to control the movement of people. That's what they are going to be doing. Don't help them do this. Instead, build capacity among your groups and people to protect yourselves and your surrounding communities. So this is an important distinction, right? I mentioned the school district and how it has marshaled people in the employ of the school district, you know, which is a small army of people. It's like 1,000 people or 100 or so. And they are being used to distribute food, right? And that's the government doing that. So there's no anti-statism coming from me. But when it comes to the police, well, that's a different issue. The military, the National Guard, when they're called into our cities, what will they be doing? Well, guy from the hood has a hypothesis there. One that is wholly backed up by recent history. Good. Just enough time for the last story I have related to the virus, flu, pandemics, states, and socialist points of view on this crisis. Now to end with some historical context. This piece is from Red Flag. So this is Red Flag, a publication also in Australia, interestingly enough. So Australia will be mentioned, but I'll skip over the kind of details that they give. I'll just give a summary of their middle part of this little essay. What is important, though? Okay, Class War in the Spanish Flu Pandemic, written by Sandra Bloodworth. Lots of people are thinking about the Spanish flu right now. It's the last time we had a worldwide influenza pandemic. That pandemic of the past didn't cause mass death. It also led to class struggle. Here's a quote for you. We were supposed to be evolving, and the millennium was only a question of time. And what happened? It was found that instead of being perfect, civilization was turned into a shambles. What an interruption to theories and optimistic fantasies. Heaven was to arrive, and lo, it was hell that came. Now, this was written in the Presbyterian Messenger in late 1919. A lot of things were happening that year. Empires were falling, breaking up. Revolutions were occurring. But was it really just World War I? Well, big cause. Big cause. But there was also this happening, because crises just kind of compound on each other. The Spanish flu, which devastated the world in several waves between 1918 and 1920, was not particularly Spanish. In fact, it was likely originated in the U.S. The first record of the condition was an April 1918 public health report informing officials of 18 severe cases and 3 deaths in Haskell, Kansas. By May, hundreds of thousands of U.S. soldiers had sailed across the Atlantic, spreading the deadly flu across Europe and into Africa and Asia. It was not the illness's origin that gave it its title, but the response of authorities to the disaster. So the authorities of the world of the 19th century and the national competition of the First World War that led to it, those empires fighting it out, which led to just how bad the pandemic was. Let's get into that. The authors of a 2005 paper delivered to the U.S. Institute of Medicine Forum on Microbial Threats, mouthful name, found every country engaged in World War I tried to control public perception of the outbreak. To avoid hurting morale, even in the non-lethal first wave, the press in countries fighting the war did not mention the outbreak. But because Spain was not in the war, its press reported the unfolding disaster, with the Spanish king being an early, much publicized victim. Spain was the first country in which political realities permitted the pandemic's acknowledgement rather than its origin. Much like today, most governments in 1918 tried to downplay the threat, pretending that their country wouldn't be in danger. In the U.S., a law was passed that made it punishable by 20 years in jail to utter, print, write, or publish any disloyal, profane, scurrilous, or abusive language about the government of the United States. You know, I think this was under the War Powers Act, basically general censorship law. So much for free speech in America, right? In wartime, it was completely destroyed, and it was used to crush socialist and anti-war movements, which were usually the same thing. Even if what you were printing about the U.S. government was true, you could be jailed, as one congressman was, but also many other thousands. The architect of massive, and by the way, this is where the court decision for free speech restriction of shouting fire in a crowded theater. This was in the context of being against the U.S. participating in World War I and being a socialist calling for ending exploitation or housing or worker rights. That's like shouting fire in a crowded theater too, apparently, because it's, you know, it's a threat to the nation. Okay. The architect of massive government propaganda proclaimed truth and falsehood are arbitrary terms. There is nothing in experience to tell us that one is always preferable to the other. The force of an idea lies in its inspirational value. It matters very little if it is true or false. Does Trump hear echoes of this wisdom as he lies and says that everyone can have a test if they want, when there is a patent lack of clinics to do even the minimum? Or when he asserted that the virus would be under control in a few days, when it was just beginning the spread? The report's authors conclude of 1918 to 1919, quoting them, "A combination of rigid control and disregard for truth had dangerous consequences. Focusing on the shortest term, local officials almost universally told half-truths or outright lies to avoid damaging morale and the war effort. They were assisted, not challenged, by the press, while, although not censored in a technical sense, cooperated fully with the government's propaganda machine." Sound familiar? In Philadelphia, when the public health commissioner closed all schools, houses of worship, theaters, and other public gathering places, one newspaper thundered that this order was not a public health measure and reiterated that there was no cause for panic or alarm. But these reassurances rang hollow as neighbors, friends, and spouses died horrible deaths. Dead bodies remained in homes for days until eventually open trucks or horse-drawn carts were sent down city streets and relatives were told to bring out the dead. The bodies were stacked without coffins and buried in mass graves. Between 50 and 100 million had died by the time the virus finally petered out in 1920. According to epidemiological studies, this was out of a world population of just under 2 billion. A similar mortality rate today would mean 175 to 350 million. Epidemiologists claim it lowered life expectancy in the U.S. by 12 years. In Australia, 15,000 died out of a population of 5 million. An epidemiologist is the people who study viruses and outbreaks. These figures reduced to mere numbers what was unimaginable horror, a physician at one typical U.S. Army camp wrote. "These men start with what appears to be an ordinary attack of la gripe or influenza. And a few hours later, you can begin to see the cytosis extending from their ears and spreading all around the face, until it is hard to distinguish the colored men from the white. It is only a matter of a few hours, then, until death comes. It is horrible to see these poor devils dropping like flies. We have been averaging about 100 deaths per day. We have lost an outrageous number of nurses and doctors. It takes special trains to carry away the dead. For several days, there were no coffins, and the bodies piled up something fierce. It beats any sight they ever had in France after a battle." That's interesting. Even the horrors of Verdun do not compare. "With no effective drugs to treat the virus, scientists concluded, in the wards in the past. Some non-medical interventions did succeed. Total isolation, cutting a community off from the outside world, did work if done early enough. Gunnison, Colorado, a town that was a rail center and was large enough to have a college, succeeded in isolating itself. So did Fairbanks, Alaska. American Samoa escaped without a single case, while a few miles away in Western Samoa, 22% of the entire population died. More interestingly, and perhaps importantly, an Army study found that isolating both individual victims and entire commands that contained infected soldiers failed when they were carelessly applied, but did some good when they were rigidly carried out. So there's an argument for, you know, martial law in its fullest with enforcement. Skip down. Industrial militancy had been strong since a general strike in 1917. Feelings among militant workers intensified in response to the contradictions between government measures intended to contain the spread of the flu, such as a ban on large gatherings, and employers' demands to work in appalling conditions. In spite of government orders that only 20 people should be in a room together, for instance, the owners of the ship Lunaguna insisted on 24 sleeping in what the Board of Health Inspector described as dog kennel accommodation. So, if you see such contradictions between our government's reactions, and, well, what happens in the next few months, maybe we need to take more militant action ourselves. Just a question. Just a implying. In January 1919, seamen on the Artawada moored in Mornington Bay walked off and refused to sign on again until they got conditions won by New Zealand crews. Transport workers in Sydney met and put all the same demands to employers. For the sake of business, some employers granted many of the claims, which would be claims for sick leave and the ability to be paid if they fall ill, or please pay our families when we die. But the government would only guarantee wages of those in quarantine or hospital. In 1919, Fremantle Wharf Riot, also known as Bloody Sunday, or the Battle of Barricades, was sparked by anger at ship owners' reckless disregard for the health of waterside workers, inflamed by wider bitterness about low wages, casualtied work, and terrible conditions. So casualtied work refers to people dying on the job regularly because of bad safety regulations. Let's jump ahead. With no vaccine and a health system even more woefully inadequate than today, we can be thankful of what we have, sort of. The confused and outright despicable responses of governments and employers determined to defend profits above all else, resulting in appalling misery for the mass of workers. Governments and employers determinedly resisted workers' demands to be treated with some dignity. Ideologically, they attempted to combat the anger and radicalism by linking the crisis to the surge of Bolshevism. See it as an opportunity to discredit the Russian Revolution, which had inspired millions to believe in the possibility of a better world. One pamphleteer observed that historical synchronization between epidemics of disease and epidemics of crime and social disorder was being repeated by the mysterious physical poison of influenza, emerged simultaneously with the vast deluge of moral and mental poison under the name Bolshevism that Jewish commies. Workers could not win everything, but they made substantial gains in pay and support for those unable to work. Critically, their struggles ensured the continuance of a militant minority determined to fight for workers' rights and against the scourge of capitalism. This is an important lesson for today. So we must also be aware, fear, and be prepared for various propaganda, as the right is probably already doing, of blaming the left for whatever ills come, as they can with their circular reasoning and ideology, whatever. That there's always an excuse that even when it's Trump being president and the shelves are bare and it's like we're in Venezuela or like we're being embargoed by someone else, that it's the left's fault. It's always the left's fault. Whether the left be Democrats or commies like me, we're all just the same enemy at the end of the day. Queers, Muslims, immigrants, those Chinese. All terrible, all a threat, all to be fought. And I'm not standing for it. Neither should you. I will share in the show notes, and this will be on the website, threelefts.news, in particular, if it doesn't show up in the podcast form, though I do put sources there as well. Something I won't read on the show because it isn't radical enough, but it is a place from the Hastings Institute. It's called Pandemics, the Ethics of Mandatory and Voluntary Interventions. I have not read this myself, but consider it a resource to further think and discuss the implications of everything that's going on. Because it really is unhelpful to just freak out about it. If you have a, you know, crisis emergency plan that involves going to family members in rural areas, as a neighbor of mine has, that's cool too. Yeah, that's cool too. Okay, so let's do a fun one. And by fun, I mean infuriating. Small scale story from Jacobin about the senators that have been caught insider trading. Now, it should be assumed that a lot of our Congress and Senate have been insider trading. They should be overthrown. They should all resign. You know, it's vote out Congress. Too many steps. They should just all resign. We should elect a new Congress, have new elections, form a new government. And those elections should be free and fair. There should be grants, at the very least, you know, since, you know, that would involve money if it's grants for campaign financing to allow people like me to do proper outreach. But otherwise, let's have elections where there's a very low barrier to entry and ranked choice ballots. Baltimore has a ranked choice voting system. They have like 30 candidates for mayor. It's great. You actually have to look, you know, see like who do you like best. Ranked choice means there's multiple runoffs, so a vote is never wasted, even when there are 30 candidates, because it's actually in a two-party system that votes are in fact wasted all the time. So anyway, let's go into the horribleness of our current Congress and government and why we should overthrow them. I mean, it's not the reason why to overthrow them. That's just my thing. Now our Senate overlords are making money off our deaths, by Branko Markacek. With the appalling Senate scandal over coronavirus insider trading, it is no longer possible to deny it. We are governed by a caste of the unimaginably rich who don't care if we live or die. A terrible crisis can reveal many things, and such is the case with the coronavirus pandemic. It's already laid bare how many of the rules that govern American life are pointless and arbitrary. See my first story today. That it's not pragmatism, but the bulging... That it's not the pragmatism, but the bulging eyes of a true believer that fuels the Democrats' economic conservatism, and the true pitiful state of the U.S. healthcare system, in quotes, demolished by decades of budget cutting. Now it's revealed just how venal those who run our country really are. Washington, D.C. has been rocked in the last day. And by the way, not mentioned in this article is the mindset of such people, which is like, well, I'm doing what's best for the common good. And since I am being such a great public servant, I deserve a little bit on the side. It's just honest graft, after all. And that is the word used by before the progressive era, before some reforms that helped a little bit with stuff like this that used to happen in the last Gilded Age. And I'm not talking about the 20s. I'm talking about like the 1890s. It was called honest graft, that, you know, if you're a public servant, you deserve to be compensated the same way that a CEO does. And this is their way of doing that. Washington, D.C. has been rocked in the last day by revelations of possible coronavirus-related insider trading by members of Congress. Though several senators have been accused, it's two in particular that the charges have been focused on. First, there's Georgia's Kelly Loeffler, who is a spouse to the chairman of the New York Stock Exchange, and with an estimated net worth of $500 million, quite possibly the richest member of Congress. That particular fact has already made Loeffler a walking, talking conflict of interest, plucked out of a committee where she would be in charge of regulating her own husband's business enterprises. On January 24th, Loeffner sat in on the private on this private senators-only briefing about the virus, which included the director of CDC and the Prevention of National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases director, Anthony Fauci. Over the next 3 weeks, until February 14th, Loeffner and her husband sold off up to 3 million stocks while buying stocks in Syntrax, a company that makes software for remote work. Bear in mind that by February 12th, a booming Dow Jones Industrial Average had hit a record high, with no signs of slowing down. Loeffner is defending herself by saying investment decisions are made by third-party advisors. It's not me, it's my broker. And that disclosure forms show that she wasn't told about any of this until February 16th. Anyway, I'll cut off there. I think you can guess the rest. They're corrupt bastards, and they don't care if we live or die. They really don't care about us. They consider themselves public servants, but they also need to be properly compensated for it. And that means getting some cheddar. Otherwise, let me read the outro. My profound thanks for listening to this program. Listening is an important skill, often as important as talking, so I plan to listen to any constructive feedback you send me. Ideas for the show, stories or topics you'd like to hear discussed. Because living in a capitalist economy isn't really that free, especially not for doing valuable work, you can show support for the show by telling others about it, liking and sharing on social media, that's Facebook and Twitter, as well as the Patreon page and donating. Although I've yet to set up like a one-time donation, but become a patron, just $1 a day, you know, makes a difference. And the most important thing, put the ideas and projects talked about here in practice yourself. Thanks, until next time, stay radical. Now, other messages for you are that website, threelefts.news, nothing else, threelefts.news, the full archive of episodes. This is episode 73. This show is podcasted. It takes me a week to edit, and I post usually at the end of the week, Friday. Usually a week ahead, behind, rather. Basically, the episode I post is the one I recorded 2 weeks ago. Yeah. I will probably not do a show next week. That way, it kind of aligns a little bit better. And that way, like, when I post a show about recent events, it's not 2 weeks ahead of time. But that can be found on any podcast app that you can find. That includes Spotify, that's Podbean, whatever you use. Okay, stay frosty, everybody. Stay isolated for now. Let's be responsible and take some action and help those in need while we are still marginally okay. Thank you very much. This has been the Three Left Show. Dan Platt.